So let me invite the other survivors from this morning's keynotes up here, and also Dan Schnapp from Hughes Hubbard. These handouts were courtesy of Dan's firm in New York City, Hughes Hubbard, about the ongoing Aereo case, which is kind of a confluence of the old school copyright law and the new cloud technology. It's pretty fascinating stuff. It's not over yet. So Sam and Mikey, come on up. I guess to start, we haven't heard from Dan yet, so why don't you introduce yourself and give us a little bit about your role and vis-a-vis, and the subject matter which we're coming up to, which will be security issues with all this stuff.
Sure. Hi, I'm happy to be here. My name's Dan Schnapp. I'm a partner and chair of the New Media and Entertainment and Technology Practice at Hughes Hubbard and Reed, based in New York, although we have offices in many areas of the country and the world. I have a handout for you guys. It's not overly legally technical, although it's a really good summary of the preeminent case Aereo and FilmOnX, which is we'll talk about later in terms of some of the challenges associated with adoption of entertainment cloud-based models. But I encourage you to read it on your own time, and certainly if you have any questions, please let us know. We're certainly at the forefront of this. We represent many stakeholders in the cloud-based solution area and arena, primarily in the film and TV business, although the music business as well, on the entertainment side. And the majority of them are content providers, although we do represent some technology solution providers as well, so that we are on both sides of the fence. So I'm going to try to keep my comments neutral in the panel discussion. But we do have a lot of expertise in dealing with the intellectual property issues specifically associated with cloud adoption, privacy and security as well. And I'm happy to be here.
Welcome. So besides having an attorney join us, the other negative factors here are that we're going to sort of zero in on what's still wrong.
Thanks, Marty.
Because we've heard a lot of hyperbolic enthusiasm. But let's start with Tom. What gives you heartburn, or what do you still, particularly from the other panel speakers you heard this morning, what still are outstanding challenges that have to be overcome?
In my mind, the cloud has a long way to mature, to really reach some complete maturity. I see it as a toddler. I see it as an 800-pound toddler, but it is going to grow immensely. One of the areas, in my opinion, in a lot of my software development, I spent many years doing financial transaction processing, the PCI compliance. All of these things present some obvious concerns in cloud computing. And security was a concern before all of the other things like the NSA and intelligence gathering, et cetera, became security concerns also. So I think the security nuts that need to be cracked in the cloud are some of the items that I think are on the critical path.
Okay. Sam, what about you? What did you hear this morning in particular that still needs to be solved?
Well, I think the big challenge, with specifically in media and delivery, the hybrid delivery is a necessity where you leverage classic channels and new channels where you might need to move data within the home. I spoke about the connected home as being broken. It still very much underlines services from DirecTV and Dish and Comcast within the home. And you need that graceful failover from local to the cloud. And, I think that the same standards body, DLNA, is starting to figure out how to bridge from the home to the cloud. UPnP Plus has some frameworks to bridge from the home to the cloud. So I think that there's a lot further work needed on that graceful discovery of where services are published and finding the most appropriate service and maintaining that continuous look and feel.
Okay, good. Bhavik?
So, excuse me. I'm the eternal optimist. I think as I presented earlier today, I think there are gaps, and it's down at this workflow level, bridging it though through network connectivity and availability of networking and building the putting the applications on top. I mean, we're very excited about what our customers have done. Netflix, case in point, what they're looking to do, and then the maturity of the applications and the shift. So I think I think there are gaps, but I think we're closing them, and they're being closed in very innovative ways.
Okay, Mikey.
I agree. I think the gaps definitely need to be closed. I think we need to have more transparency between cloud providers and clients, trying to figure out, you know, when we run into problems, how to solve them together, give us better insights into, changes in the cloud, within the cloud environment, give us more insights into the types of hardware and virtualization that we have that's also really missing.
Okay. Dan, a different perspective maybe on what do you see as the biggest gap between the promise and realization today?
I think from a legal perspective and an operational perspective, and this is really no different in the cloud space than any other space when you're talking about law and technology, is that law is just always lagging behind technological innovation, and this is really a key area where it is problematic for rapid adoption across the world. If you look at the Aereo case, you've got two circuits that are split down the middle on the West Coast and the East Coast in terms of what the transmit clause of the Copyright Act actually means. And that's problematic, and that's why this is ripe for Supreme Court to decide whether, what Aereo is doing is legal or not. But it is a disruptive technology, and it's just an example, one of many in the cloud space where it's disrupting a particular industry. Another thing that I think of that is problematic for adoption purposes is just the lack of standards and interoperability requirements. Not so much necessarily in the public sector, in the government sector, where the NIST is leading that charge. But I think if you look across the commercial enterprise cloud-based solutions, there really isn't a set of standards that you could point to, or that your clients can point to and say, yeah, this is the way it's supposed to be done. And I think one of the things that Young was talking about before, which kind of raised my eyebrow because I was just negotiating a contract with Microsoft on Azure, you've got the engineers that are mentioning that to their potential clients and prospective clients that there's no single point of failure in a virtual machine environment on Azure, but the contract doesn't specifically doesn't stand behind those words. So you've got an issue that inequality that you're talking about your product and you're talking about your service, how great it is, and that it's always going to be up and running, but for mission critical things in the entertainment space where timing is everything, mm-hmm. Things are seasonal, and they need to be available and integrated, and continuous availability and distribution is important. When you don't have a remedy and you don't have a commitment contractually, it's problematic for anybody to actually step in if the skin in the game isn't on the vendor side.
So anybody, do you have a question about any gaps from what you heard this morning? Any questions about what you saw as maybe a hole in a presentation or a concern you had before we move on? Larry, Sarah, could you give him the microphone so we get this on recording? So we're going to webcast this, so please use a mic so we can capture your questions and comments. Thanks.
Oh, hi. This is a question for Mr. Rosen. You were mentioning that the connected home with the local sort of connectivity is, I don't know what expression you use, dead, not working, not flourishing.
I just wanted to fail.
What's that?
Epic fail.
Right. The question, which I'll follow with a comment to explain the question, is do you think it's like dead, cold, rigor mortis, and never to be resuscitated? And I'm just curious as to the why of that, because first of all, we live in Bethesda, Maryland, and so Verizon is very big in our area, and they advertise a lot, and they've been advertising a product called, I think it's eShare, which I think is based on that concept of sort of local. And the concept seems really pretty attractive, where you'd have some sort of repository, I don't know exactly where it would be, and your pictures from Machu Picchu would be available on your smartphone, on your tablet, on your big TV, on your computer. So the concept seems kind of intriguing. It seems like Verizon's messing around with it. So I've always been wondering about it, and I know you have the background and the information. I'm just curious, is it dead, gone, and forever gone? Is it something that may come back, or and where do you see that going?
Yeah, I think you have to break it down to a technology perspective, you know, an implementation perspective and a service perspective. So from the implementation perspective, the idea that you are the master of your media, you store it all locally, and you can access it from anywhere, I generally see as dead and gone. So, you know, I have a nice NAS in my home. For me to go when I'm out and about and get to that NAS, I need to know how to configure my network router. You know, I need to know a lot about how to get an IP address to come into my home because I have a dynamic IP address. And nobody has successfully solved that complexity, and no standard has effectively solved that complexity, so that any standards-based approach that is service agnostic, that is to say that it works for music and it works for video and it works for photos, no service that is content agnostic has been able to be standardized. And so what you've had is this development of these vertical silos, and you have to choose who to trust. Do you want to trust Verizon? Do you want to trust Google? Do you want to trust Apple? Do you want to trust the ultraviolet ecosystem for each of these services? So you can get the benefits of these services very well within a unified silo that provides you, you know, 8 of the 12 things that you want. Or you can choose each individually. But the way they're going to be delivered is always going to be an elastic, you know, device to cloud perspective, so that your NAS drive is going to have a cloud service with cloud storage affiliated with it that routes around those barriers in the home and lets you access it. And you're more likely to have more services that are siloed in their implementation. So you need the cloud to solve the problems right. of the home.
So the concept will come, but it's just the cloud will be a piece of the puzzle, is what you're saying.
Yes. Got yes. It.
Right here.
Hi. Two questions, I think, for two different bunch of people here. Dan, you mentioned your comment about the maturity level of some of the vendors in regards to the contracts versus reliability and what happens when things fall apart. That's a big issue for my company. Is it going to take time, or is it going to be more different contracts that have to be developed to address this going forward?
I think
for the record, just let us know who you are.
I'm with NBC Universal.
Thank you.
Being that NBC Universal is one of our clients, I'll be cautious about the answer. But I think the issue really is probably one of time, simply because the attorneys that are drafting these contracts are relying on general outsourcing based models, as opposed to cloud-based models, and a lot of the provisions that are in these agreements, they tend to be contracts of adhesion, click wrap agreements that aren't negotiated. I think in the public cloud space, when we move to a hybrid cloud space, which most of our clients are doing in the entertainment space, in the entertainment industry, for more of their mission critical type of applications, I think you have a lot more room to negotiate those provisions and have meaningful remedies, where the vendors tend to have a little bit more skin in the game because there's more customization, and it's not just renting, you know, time and space and virtual servers and data centers. So I think, you know, short answer is yes, it's going to take time for those to flesh out, and you know, one typically follows the other in terms of risk allocation and liability. But there are, you know, there are ways to mitigate your risk contractually, and that's one of the things that we do for our clients.
Okay. And then the second question is for the folks from Netflix and Amazon. The failure last year, and at Christmas time, was definitely made press, you know, in that regards. What have you guys done, you know, because I like your comment, Mike, about everyone's in bubbles, cloud bubbles, and you guys have to kind of like agree to work together when there's an issue. But what have you guys put in place in regards to process that you guys will to, other than working faster and learning better from these mistakes, to actually address this issue? Because from an entertainment perspective, again, when we have a time issue or event, we can't have a failure. And that's the, you know, when a failure occurs, we just, you know, we're dead in the water. And I just want to understand how you guys, given the two leading companies here, pushing clouds, what are you guys doing to actually minimize the failure going forward?
I think for, you know, ELB types of failure, I mean, we still have to go on the assumption that things are going to fail. So really, I think my key point is that resiliency is the issue. So for ELBs, you know, we move to another region so that we can have regional failover. So we have an active region on the West Coast, an active region on the East Coast, and we could just switch DNS so that, you know, zones were within a region. People thought, I think at first, that zones were going to be, you know, a zone can go out. That's a, you know, zone is a physical data center. So generally, you would have a zone failure, but we really didn't think about, you know, regional failures. So from a tactical point of view, I think we have to, Netflix needs to, we just need to be resilient, expect failure, and be resilient to it. From a relationship point of view between Netflix and, you know, or any cloud customer and Amazon or any cloud provider, I want to emphasize, like, I think transparency is really good. I think, you know, when we run into issues internally inside of our Netflix bubble, we're very transparent about the problems, you know, how the subscriber service is having problems or whatever. You know, we are very transparent about it. But then when we try to get to, hey, there could be a network issue with Amazon, it tends to not be very transparent. I think that the, you know, our, what changes were made, what's going on, like that stuff, I think is really just probably a matter of Amazon, like, evolving the way that they're thinking about things. I don't really know. I don't know if you have a better answer.
I don't know. I mean, on this specific one, I think we strive to make services like Amazon and the infrastructure underneath work as it should. And that specific failure has been well documented as to what actually happened, what the cascading problems were, and how we've tried to remedy that problem. And so we take these things very seriously. There is that whole engineering paradigm, though, of designing for failure and testing for failure and testing for resiliency. I mean, this is very much about the economics of what the cloud brings. And so to get that value, it's very different to building a data center and putting in full redundancy and running HA or active-active or active-passive, right? So those concepts exist. And so we strive in both planes, I think. One is to change the way engineering is done in delivering services so that you have resiliency. And then secondly, when things occur, like the event at Christmas, we do try to be transparent, we do investigate, we do deliver very detailed explanations as to what happened, and then internally we strive to ensure that they don't happen again. And I'd be happy to send you the detailed posting that we put in for that specific Christmas Eve one.
I think just one thing that I think from a network or client perspective, from a consumer of cloud services, that frustrates our clients a lot is the fact that, yes, the transparency is there and the skin in the game to a certain extent has increased and will increase over time, and the cooperation is key. I think for an ad campaign or some tentpole event where there is a critical piece that's missing because there's an outage, if there's a complete disclaimer of consequential damages or lost profits or revenue associated with it, there is no meaningful remedy. And that's really the gap from a contractual perspective. If the service providers are not willing to step up the game and come to a meeting of the minds with their clients that, yes, there has to be a little bit more on the give from a risk allocation perspective in order to compensate them for those failures, at the same time keeping in mind that, you know, you can't guarantee 100% availability at any particular point. There has to be something more than just, you know, a straight service level credit for services, you know, on a monthly basis.
Good. And with that, redefining force majeure. Very well done. Okay, right here. I think there's another question next to.
Yeah, when the music stops, I guess. Now, so this is somewhat of a follow-up question on reliability, and I guess maybe first Bavik and Dan and the whole panel. But so, yeah, AWS has an SLA. I've read it carefully a few times. And the last time I read it, it was a 3.9s service. And with what we do, we tend to look at Amazon as a set of building blocks. And I think sometimes the end user side tends to see Amazon as a completed solution. A guy from Netflix has taken us pretty carefully through the effort that Netflix put in over a period of 4 years and hard work and failure to get to the level of resiliency and reliability that they have right now. We also know that across multiple instances of AWS regional availability outages, that different services have different survivability designed into them. And if you go into Amazon right now, you'll see there are thousands of AMIs, and there are lots of services both that are part of the Amazon cloud platform and that come from third parties that can allow you to address high availability, resiliency, with different degrees of failover capability. So I guess my question is, first to Amazon. I think Amazon's basic approach is to provide the building blocks. And then the service providers like Netflix and other third parties, some of our clients, it's up to us to build solutions to a certain level of reliability and resiliency that is expected by our customers. So that really, I think, from a legal standpoint, Amazon's SLA has established what they're willing to provide with these building blocks. And now it becomes up to the service provider who's building a solution on Amazon or helping a large enterprise like NBC Universal build something on Amazon. It's up to that organization to implement a certain degree of resiliency, availability, and reliability. And so the question is that what the real world really is right now? And in that case, what do we do about it?
That's Russ Hertzberg from SoftServe.
Yes.
For the record.
Go ahead. So, and to pull out a question maybe from that, I mean, I think it goes back a little bit to what we were saying. Right? Yes, our SLAs are published. That you've read them, and we make them very available as part of what we offer. But we also, with that, right, come the economics of cloud. You, no CapEx investment up front. You pay for what you use. You can use as much and as little as you want. And then we at the engineering level, it is all about it's designing in a new way. It's taking advantage of those economics and designing for failover, designing for resiliency, using multiple availability zones, multiple regions, different ways of using those services to build this reliability up. And we have, you know, hundreds of thousands of customers. A lot of them run mission critical, revenue critical applications on our platform. So we are, I think, collectively learning how to do this better, how to build the services, and we're providing the tools and listening to our customers with respect to what they need next in order to really take advantage of this type of infrastructure.
You know, from your question about the service providers as being kind of the intermediary, I completely agree with you, but that also brings another level of complexity into the mix because you have another stakeholder involved and potentially another contract that is divergent from what Amazon or any other cloud provider is going to offer either publicly or directly. So I give you a perfect example. We represent a major cable network / venue owner in New York. And as part of a launch of a new application for one of their forums, it was, you know, for customers and patrons to order food and variety of things and concessions at a particular sporting event. And it was a brand new application. You had the application provider and service provider. You had Microsoft Azure in the background, and you had a couple of other marketers and promoters. And everybody had separate terms and they didn't necessarily mix. So one of the things that needs to be done is to bring the parties together to the extent you can into one contractual arrangement, especially the major ones, whether it be the cloud service provider and the service provider themselves, and have meaningful remedies that actually interconnect and work together, as opposed to the majority of the time when clients come to us when there was a problem. If there was an outage on the back end and it wasn't Microsoft's fault or it was the service provider's fault, they'll go like this. And you don't want to be in a situation as a consumer
right.
of cloud services or any other service that's offered by a service provider when they're going like this with their subcontractor.
It's a bad thing. You had a question, Jerry?
Jerry Stegmaier, Wilson Sonsini. Great discussion, and maybe building off of what Dan was discussing. I'd love to just sort of hear a reaction about best practices for collaborating as a team, right, or an ecosystem, right? So in Dan's example, that I think he was talking about, if half of the components of your solution are off the shelf, non-negotiated, because they're building blocks, for example, but other things are custom and developed, what are the thoughts from the panelists on the best way to address that? If you're on the buy side, right, in other words, you're the consumer, and you might be, you know, a large co, big entity, right, so you may have some leverage, but essentially how do you, you know, in other words, let me put it a different way. What do you ask for, and what can you get, and what is the flexibility within the ecosystem to accommodate that, right? So if you're the SaaS guy where the terms are non-negotiable, and your customer comes and says, look, I have this one customer, and they're really special, and I need variation. Just maybe you guys could react to that generally.
Who wants to start?
From the Amazon perspective, I mean, we publish our SLAs, and I think that the scale that we're trying to operate at and the diverse customer base and the global nature of the business makes, for one-offs, a little bit more complex. I think it's harder for me to answer because I think it very much depends on the customer and what the customer is expecting from their vendors and what they're trying to build. So that economic risk profile is really there.
Let's assume it's not the 999s person, but rather it's the 000s. In other words, however many zeros
are involved that cause you to go, yeah, there's this scale issue, but I want that money.
I think then it's visited, right? I mean, I can only speak more broadly as to what we, you know, we're trying to offer a very low cost, easily accessible service, and hence our SLAs are such. And then for those one-offs, I'm sure discussions happen, but I have not been privy to them, so I couldn't really comment.
I mean, as an analyst, I think that you see different companies, as he's talking about, right? We want to be widely available. We want to be there for everyone. And I have to say it is informative in terms of the quality that you have customers that have started out small and grown and continued to scale on AWS. You have other markets where you tend to have sort of the entry-level guys, you know, sort of the mid-tier guys and the big, you know, the big guns, right? And the CDN network, I would say, is sort of like that, where the online video platforms, if you're mom and pop, if you own a website and you're pushing out a few hundred videos, you know, the OVPs tend to be your first stop. As you get larger, you start to think more about going direct to the CDN. You start to have a little bit more buying power. You need that aggregate leverage that the OVP provides in buying that delivery a little bit less. You might continue to use some features of the OVP platform, whether that be analytics, whether that be advertising support. And you see this tier of, you know, of scale. And you see entry-level providers, mid-tier providers, and advanced providers. And I think cloud is very much the same way, where if, as your requirements start to get to be, you know, not only mission critical, but you're looking for more risk, you might have to migrate from a more elastic, more off-the-shelf platform to something that IBM's providing, where really it's just changing the business model around that classic hosted IT that's over-provisioned and brought out and might give you some of the business benefits without really adopting the technology.
Any other question on this one? All right, let's turn the page a little bit. I'll start with Mikey on this one, come down. So from what we heard this morning, what supposed problems do you think are more mythological, like they're really not problems, that we can just blow past this year?
I know we've been talking a lot about cloud security, and I think that the Amazon infrastructure itself is very, very secure. And I think the way that, you know, at least we have organized our data and everything, like there are some aspects of our service that it doesn't really matter if metadata is exposed somehow or something, you know. So the way that our services are exposed, like, I think our vulnerability is sort of small towards security breaches. But like within, I think, you know, we talk a lot about security and everything like that, but like I don't, obviously, I think at this point I'm not really speaking as much about, as a, for Netflix, maybe they're more concerned than I am, but I think that the Amazon cloud itself is a very, very secure platform. And day to day, those are the things that I'm not that worried about.
Bhavik?
This was about
mythological problems we really don't have, but we can.
Yeah, I mean, so that, I mean, it's maybe more from a media perspective, but the objections are always you can't get your data in, and it's not secure enough. And I don't believe any of those to be true. I mean, I think we're seeing businesses adopt and see the value in media workflows. There is effort to get data in, but it's with native solutions available from the platform and a wide variety of excellent third-party providers to ease the ingest problem. It can be solved. Bandwidth is reducing in cost. It's highly available. And then the security perspective, I think, you know, we security is paramount, and it's both the service provider's responsibility and the customer's. And we strive to provide as many tools and solutions to augment that on the platform. And then customers themselves can also encrypt their data prior to it being encrypted even at rest on the platform. So I think those two things they continue to evolve, but I think they continue to mature, and I think they're not obstacles anymore.
Hmm. Okay. Sam, what are you seeing from your perspective?
I mean, we've talked a bit about legal and how legal lags technology. And I think we've started to see in cases where the business case is strong enough to go back and renegotiate that contract, you can see security requirements fall as the opportunity is large. And if you look at a lot of the interplay between piracy and legal delivery services and what that means in terms of how you get something out there, what NBC Universal has done with the Olympics, you know, some of the opportunities to get Game of Thrones, you know, in Indonesia, in a legal service. I think in those cases, the content owners, the cloud providers, the service providers can come together and say, let's get past this legal restriction. We've had these handcuffs we've put on you because the business opportunity here is X. The cost of piracy is Y, and we can do better than that. And so I think that the myth is that things don't change. I think they do change where there's a big enough opportunity.
Good one. Tom?
I think one of the myths that's out there is that there's an inherent angst in some IT organizations that outsourcing to cloud, that they lose some measure of control. And when in fact the reality is that cloud providers are really in the business of enabling those IT organizations to do more and to do better.
That's a good one. Dan, what do you think? Where are there no more billable hours?
I don't know if there's necessarily any myths that I can identify that haven't already been identified, but I think a lot of things get blown out of proportion because they're problems that existed pre-cloud anyway. For example, security and privacy have been around since the internet existed, or distributed computing for that matter, in every industry. This is just a modicum of risk that's increased by the nature of the technology and the amount of stakeholders involved. I think cross-border data transfer is an issue in cloud, but it's always been an issue with distributed computing. It's just on a different level. So I don't necessarily think I could add any specific myth. Maybe from a business cost, just knowing some of these implementations that I've been involved in, I've heard that, you know, cloud costs less, or that's, you know, a driving factor to move to the cloud. I don't think that's always true in most instances, at least the ones that I've been involved in recently.
Different advantages. Who has a question about or a comment about issues we may be still hearing about that aren't quite real? Anybody? Any comments? Jerry?
Uh,
I'd be interested in, to the extent anybody can react, to whether they're actually seeing NSA-related issues come up in deals. In other words, I don't want to do business with you because of the threat of national security and surveillance, as opposed to what we read in the paper, right? But what's really going on in the weeds?
I can't say that I have dealt with a specific NSA issue, and that there was a reluctance to do a deal or enter into an arrangement or relationship because of one. Security is certainly a major issue, but not from an NSA perspective, at least in the deals that I've done.
I can say that Rackspace has not received any blanket warrants or participate in any wholesale metadata searches. So maybe there's a bit of a myth there that this is happening wholesale across the industry, but we have not participated in those.
Amazon, how about any international incidents?
I'm no comment from my side. Okay. I don't have visibility into that.
We all saw the Gartner's report about $35 billion of business to U.S. cloud computing providers evaporated.
As an analyst, right, a year before this broke, it was Huawei being hauled before the Senate, right? Mm-hmm. And it was the risk of China spying here. And to me, it seems very apparent that from a code perspective, that code audits should be able to identify where data is reported back to whom and why, and that, you know, a periphery offense of sniffers, you know, or whatever, can on an operational basis, you know, monitor what is going where and to whom, understanding that there should be a lot of encryption. And, you know, an encrypted data can't be inspected the same way that in the clear data can. But to me, it's a little surprising that it's percolated up to that level without the technologists coming to the table and winning out in the end of the day over the business challenges and the political and constituency issues of it.
Okay, we have a question over here.
Yeah, actually, it's a comment related to that. I'm Tom Moran. I'm with Savvis, which is part of CenturyLink. We're a large cloud provider all over the world. And as it relates to your question about the NSA stuff, I think really the challenge is not specific to that type of privacy or security issue, but it's the fact that you have different regulations all over the world related to privacy, in particular in Europe now. There's a lot of legislation that's probably going to drive cloud providers to be forced to store data in country for various reasons. And I think that's a much bigger concern as an operator of a service or somebody who owns data, is going to be storing data around the world, than whether or not the NSA is hacking into your stuff. It's going to be, how many different countries do I have to have it stored in order to meet the requirements of a local market? And I think that's going to become a big issue. And there's going to be, you know, there was a mention of cloud being a toddler. I think that's a very apt statement.
That's a good one, Tom. Thank you. Reza had a question.
Thanks. Reza Rasool, Quio Corporation. Tom, you said cloud's a toddler. And Sam, you're looking at the trends of cloud as it's maturing. Can you tell us about the pricing of cloud and how is that maturing? We noticed that both Azure and the Google Compute Engine have now announced sub-hour billing. And we recall how the mobile industry matured when it went from three-minute billing down to minute billing. And in Europe, we even see sub-minute billing. So can you comment on that?
Tom, you want to go first?
I can comment metaphorically, I guess. I started engineering outside of high tech, and it was actually in the workforce when the first handheld calculators came along, and they were $300 a piece. And it was within a few years they were $20-$30, and commodity pricing took over. I believe the same thing is happening in cloud computing. I know it's something that is under constant scrutiny and evaluation at Rackspace. And I can say without hesitation, over the next 3 to 6 months, you know, there will be changes.
Pavic, you want to add something?
I mean, you know, no customers ever complained to us about us lowering our prices. And so we've lowered them, I think, over 26 times since we've been in business. I mean, it's a constant, it's something that we're constantly striving to do. And so lowering prices remains a trend for us going forward and offering, hopefully, offering that value back to customers.
I mean, I would say compute clearly follows Moore's law in terms of cost of a given entity, and networking, you know, similar advances. I think the bigger question is on the margins, and I don't see that the gross margins of appliances, cloud appliances, you know, really facing pressure in the competitive world, given the number of people that can do it, the technical sophistication to do it. At the same time, I think that the demand for margins is such that you really see the focus of every cloud business on what value-added services are differentiating, how they can make sure that it is not a commodity decision. And so you will have those people that fail to differentiate their value that are going to be selling an appliance at, you know, 20 to 30% margins. And then those that really get the value-added services will be able to sustain better margins there.
Can I just follow up? It wasn't so much about the price or even the margin. It's more about the pricing unit, the time unit of the pricing, which is currently the common standard is an hour long. So even if you only burst into the public cloud for a spike of traffic for 3 minutes or 15 minutes or whatever, you're being charged for the entire hour.
Yeah, I can't say if we have looked at the granularity of the unit of measure or not. That's valid. It may be something to look at.
It all comes down to the setup and teardown time and the economics of that. So I guess if you're pushing a technology that's in that domain, it's a very important question. And then the question becomes what applications have that burstiness at that level. And I think that's, you know, that's the second question that would take further research.
Mr. West.
Hi, Mike West. From the point of view of a cloud service provider, data centers or otherwise, what are the real cost drivers and which ones are going to move and which ones are going to stay the same? Can you give us any predictions 6 months out, a year out, 2 years out? But what's really driving the cost and what will drive the cost down?
Driving cost of providing cloud?
Yeah. Providing all kinds of cloud services.
So it's the data center, it's the hardware, it's the electricity. I mean, when you look at the volumes that go into that, it's all adds into a significant portion of the per hour server cost. To give you a for instance, to this day, every one of our servers on a rack that is used to provision a cloud has a graphics card in it. Will never be used. It has a USB port. Will never be used. So we are working with hardware manufacturers. There's the open project for hardware, and I think there's going to be a lot of changes in that direction to bringing cost into alignment with what's being provisioned.
So Moore's law at least applies to that.
Right. Yeah.
What about the other things that are in there?
I can't, public utilities, electricity, that's the other one. I don't know, if more wind farms, I don't know.
Okay, let's do one last question. It's a parting shot. We're encroaching on lunchtime, so let's start with Dan. What's just one thing that media sector end users could do in conjunction with cloud computing providers to kind of accelerate the pace of progress here? How could we work together to move this, advance this further, faster?
It's a loaded question, but I think, unfortunately, a lot of this is, from my perspective, is going to be litigation-based, and until Congress decides, at least in this country, to change certain laws and to enact ones that actually work and stand the test of time. You look no further than the DMCA, that's just already outdated. It's probably outdated a year and a half after it was enacted. It's really difficult to say. If I had to choose one, I think both sides, and I keep saying skin in the game, I really do believe wholeheartedly that when I've seen successful implementations and I've seen deals, and I've done a lot of them, as kind of counsel that represents both sides, when it works because they are cooperating and they realize that there's risk involved in everything and that you can't shift all the risk to one side of the fence versus the other. There has to be a shared set of risk that extends beyond the kind of norms or standards that have been set by the market today. It can't be a situation where the large players and the ones that have the most leverage are getting the better coverage simply because there's more dollars involved for the service providers. There certainly are certain levels of service that carry more risk, and those obviously have more customization involved and room for negotiation. But if I'm a service provider and I really want to drive my service, I'm going to make it accessible to everyone, and I'm going to make sure that I'm taking care of the little guys as well as the big guys at the same time.
Thanks. Tom?
I think one of the things that's very current with Rackspace in our legal department is, and it's been a major annoyance, and it's been a significant cost, is patent trolls. And I'm not talking about people, with legitimate patents, but as technology moves along, the people that have a squishy patent that might, look similar, they come in and they want a few hundred thousand dollars to just go away. And in the last year, Rackspace Legal has taken a decision to go after these cases hammer and tong. And it's something I think that the whole industry would be behoove us to get behind, because it's like the groceries at the neighborhood grocery store go down when the mafia is gone and you don't pay protection to money anymore. And I'm not ashamed of that analogy, by the way. And again, I'm not talking about legitimate mm-hmm. patents. So we all want to be open and honest in how we're dealing with each other, but it's the real patent trolls.
Okay, good one. Sam?
I think that the innovation is happening, that the cloud enablement of innovation to the consumer is happening. Obviously, there are business model test cases. We've spoken about Aero. There are others in other parts of the world that are going to be settled out as the course of this, as has always happened in, Sony Betamax and et cetera cases. I would say I'm relatively rosy that people are working together, bringing innovative services, leveraging the cloud for incremental opportunities that build on their current businesses, and where the benefits of the cloud match those business benefits. So I think it's going well.
Good one. Babik?
So I'm deeply immersed on the media side, so I think it's, I think continuing to focus on customers and delivering the services that the customers need, and then bringing the right partner mix, and we're seeing great adoption of the platform and fantastic partner solutions really closing that gap and accelerating the adoption. And I think in conjunction, those two things really drive this acceleration. So it's really bringing value through first both areas, but really focusing on the right solutions natively in the platform, and the right customer mix, and the right systems integrated pool, and really driving that ecosystem to deliver value.
Okay. Last word from Mikey.
I think some of the standardization with DRM and that sort of thing, HTML tags for the video tag, is going to be good once that standardizes, as far as helping everybody through video. I agree too, the patent stuff, patent trolls, really, that patent litigation really needs to happen that would really stifle innovation for small and big companies. So, yeah.
Thank you very much, panelists. Appreciate it.